Well, welcome everybody to the Bible class of the Atlanta Church of Christ in Gwinnett. It's great to be together this morning. Saw a lot of you guys Friday evening. We had a great all-night prayer time. Hope everybody has caught up on your sleep, and if not, then let's wait until this afternoon to do that. But we're going to be talking about the book of Judges today. We're in an Old Testament survey. And in an Old Testament survey, you kind of move quickly. What we're doing is we're going to cover the whole book of Judges in today. And so, like I said, it's going to be basically telling the story of what happened in Judges. We have, in previous weeks, as you might guess, we have covered Genesis and the life of Moses, which basically covers Exodus through Deuteronomy. And basically talked about what happened to the people there. And then last week, Gary talked about the entering the promised land, Joshua, the book of Joshua. And so today we'll be moving on beyond the book of Joshua to the book of Judges. Before we start, let's have a prayer. Father, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for giving us the chance to come together this morning to study it, to learn more about how you have interacted with your people, about what you call us to be and what you call us to do. Father, we thank you for your love. We thank you for providing us with this time and your word. Please be with us as we study it. Help us to get from it what you intend for us to. We need you, we love you, and we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. Book of Joshua was a very exciting book, a very successful book. It's, you could sort of subtitle it, if you want to put a subtitle on the book, it's like Success Through Following God, right? They weren't perfect, but in the book of Joshua, they basically did what God told them to, and as a result, they entered the promised land, and they took the promised land. And what we're going to find this morning is they didn't do all of it. And you know, we saw a few things last week where they didn't do everything perfectly. But we're going to find some things that they left undone. That's going to create problems that persisted all the way through the whole time of the kingdom of Israel. And so, we'll see what they didn't do and what that led to. So, you know, the book of Judges, it's a little bit difficult chronologically, especially like the last five chapters. Most people think those didn't really happen chronologically at the end of Judges. But basically, we're not going to worry too much about that. It happened whenever it happened, and it's in the Bible for a reason. But what we're going to find is basically it occurred after Joshua. They've entered the promised land, and it persisted up through the book of Samuel, 1 Samuel. Actually, you know, people have said that Samuel is the book of the last two judges and the first two kings. Okay, and I can see why you'd say that. But basically, it's the period of Judges extended until Saul was made king in Samuel. And that was about a period probably of 350 years where Israel was led by judges in the promised land. Out of that 350 years, about 300 of those years were actually the book of Judges itself. And the extra 50 is the overlap into Samuel. So, and again, the book of Judges is about 300 years. So, let's see if my wife's doing the clicker, so hopefully we'll stay synchronized. The book of Judges, another book that happened, tells us events that happened at the same time is the book of Ruth. If you check Ruth chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "In the days when the judges ruled," and it starts talking about some things that happened. So, it doesn't take a degree in theology to figure out that book happened at the same time as the book of Judges. We're not going to cover that, but one of the things I like to do as we go through sort of the timeline of the Bible is sort of figure out what things happened at the same time. Help me understand sort of the context of these different books and how they relate to each other. So during this time of the Judges, Israel was a theocracy. Okay, that's a little bit of a fancy word we don't use every day, but basically it means it's a country governed by God. Basically God's law is the law of the land. And so it wasn't a separate government and church. It wasn't a separation of church and state. It was exactly the opposite. There wasn't really a state. It was the that God was the king, and God did not appoint a successor to Joshua. Okay, you know, it's interesting when he appointed Moses to lead him out of the promised land. When Moses died, he appointed Joshua. When Joshua died, he didn't appoint anybody new, and that wasn't a mistake. God didn't just kind of forget, right? It was his choice to not appoint a successor to Joshua. And so Israel was ruled by God. God made the laws. There were judges appointed who would administer justice based on those laws. And this was God's plan for governing Israel. That was the way he wanted it done. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the judges. Who were judges? Why are they called judges? If you go back through the Bible and the history where we first hear about the judges, it was when Moses' father-in-law came and said, you know, I want you to appoint people over 50s and hundreds and thousands and so forth to help you lead the people. And in Exodus 18, verses 21 and 22, he told Moses, but select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times. And he goes on and tells them more about it. But those were judges. And they were appointed. This was while they were wandering around in the wilderness, okay, under Moses. Under Moses, that we had that reiterated in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 15 to 18. It was a command of God, you know, just as Jethro had said, you know, God told him to do that. So that was the way God wanted them led. Of course, then they also had Moses. All right. And then when you get to the promised land, well, in Deuteronomy chapter 16, he lays out the law for what they need to do when they get to the promised land. Deuteronomy 16, verse 18 says, appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God is giving you, and they shall judge the people fairly. So, you know, just slightly different from what Jethro said. Here he says, appoint them in every town. Now, why didn't Jethro tell him to appoint them in every town? There weren't any towns, right? They were out in the wilderness. They were all living in tents. And so they were by tribes. Now, they're still by tribes because they're basically living, their towns are by tribes. Each tribe was given different regions, geographic regions. But they were to be led in by a local group of judges in each town. According to Deuteronomy 16. You know, the system of judges was not an inferior system of government. You know, a lot of times, many of us may have heard a sermon or a lesson at some point in time about a sentence that comes out a few times in the book of Judges. It says, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. And you say, okay, well, you know, if only we had a king, we would do what was right instead of what we see fit. That's kind of how those lessons have gone, you know. But that's not really the lesson of Judges. That's not the point. The point here was that things were great when people saw fit to do good, and they were bad when people saw fit to do evil. If you look at how things went once they got a king, they didn't go so well, did they? You know, you remember that chart we put up where it showed the evil kings and the good kings and the different colors? And there's a lot of evil kings, right? And you know, the great thing about when you do as you see fit is when you do good, you're doing it out of your own heart. When you got somebody making you do good, where's the moral value of that? Where's the satisfaction to God that somebody made him do good? You know, but when everybody is doing good because it's coming from their heart, then that glorifies God and that pleases God. And we're going to see that as we go through Judges. It happens sometimes, but it didn't always happen. Okay, so, and again, you know, if you look in 1 Samuel chapter 8, we're just sort of surrounding the book of Judges right now, talking, sort of setting the, you know, where does it fit in the sequence of things. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, when the people asked for a king, God was not pleased. I'm going to read just a few verses here. He says, so all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. That should be a sign that it's not a good idea, right? We want to be like the other nations. It goes on, he says, but when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. Okay. So God was not pleased. So as I said, you know, the period of the kings was not a more righteous period than the period of the judges. What we're going to read about in Judges, you're going to read about some strange stuff. You know, you're going to think, you know, some of these people did a lot of bad things as well as some good things. But it's all there for us to learn from. All right. So basically, a little bit more about Judges through the ages. Basically, according to Jewish historians, again, this traces back to Jethro, but in the Jewish judicial system, civil cases would be heard by three judges. Higher cases would be heard by a court of 21 judges. And the highest court was the Sanhedrin, which would, by the time of the Second Temple, this was, you know, after Babylon, there was 71 judges that would make up the Sanhedrin. So you had sort of this hierarchy. The Sanhedrin was like the Supreme Court in their day. So it kind of gives you an idea of where the Sanhedrin came from and also sort of how the judges sort of evolved over time. But that was the judicial system. During the book of Judges, what we have is there was judges in every town, right? But what we read about is certain judges that were raised up at certain points in time to be deliverers. You know, you might name the book Deliverers. You know, it might be a good name for the book because the people got in trouble and then along comes God raises up one of these judges to deliver the people from their captors. So that's what we have. So we have seven deliverers. We have Othniel. We have Ehud. You know, and when you get to teach this class one day, maybe you can pronounce these names however you want to. Okay, Ehud is what I'm going to say. You got Shamgar, Barak and Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. Basically those were the deliverers that those ones we're going to really talk about. There were others. There was a guy named Tola who rose to save Israel. There was Jair. Jair had 30 sons and rode on 30 donkeys, and that's about all we know about him. Okay. So, 30 sons and 30 donkeys. That's his claim to fame. We have Ibzah, who had 30 sons and 30 daughters. Okay, so presumably that's, you know, I have two daughters. You know, I think very highly of them. So I would assume that 30 daughters is better than 30 donkeys, right? Okay. Elon led Israel for 7 years. That's all we know about him. And we have a guy by the name of Abdon, who had 40 sons, 30 grandsons, and 70 donkeys. You know, there's this thing about donkeys. You know, I don't know what it is. My best guess is that the reason that's recorded is that when you have a lot of sons and a lot of daughters and a lot of donkeys, that it's a prosperous time. Okay, you're being blessed. Okay, that's kind of how I take that. So those guys led Israel during prosperous times. Of course, what usually happened is towards the end of those times, they're in captivity again because they've done something bad, and then they need another deliverer. So basically, let's go to the book of Joshua now. Time to look at it a little bit. The book of Judges. We're talking about Judges today. Judges 2, verse 7. I want to start there. It said, the people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. So throughout the life of Joshua and the elders who outlived him, it says they served the Lord. You know, it was a good time. They saw what God had done. They realized how great God is. Now a lot of these people had wandered around the desert because their parents didn't do that, right? You know, I think that there's a part of it was attributable to the fact that their parents weren't too impressed by crossing the Red Sea. These people crossed the Jordan River and they were pretty impressed. Okay, they realized what happens when you don't obey God. So they had learned that lesson. But the next generation, Judges 2 verse 10, says, after that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. So that was not that's not a happy thought. So even though this generation that did right, you know, respected God and all that, their kids didn't. They didn't pass it down. It's another example of a generation that didn't pass it to the next generation. You know, and that happens throughout the Bible over and over and over. If you look at the kings, you might have a good king, but his son would be one of the bad kings, sometimes one of the worst. You know, you see over and over where the one generation doesn't pass it down to the next. And, you know, that's no easier for us than it was for them. We have to pay attention to that. Hopefully we can learn, you know, like we looked at a couple of weeks ago, don't be like them, you know, when we see that happen. But so that next generation didn't know. So let's go to Judges. We're going to get started in chapter 1, and I'm not going to be reading a lot there, but in chapter 1, it talks about Judah and Simeon, and they made this pact, the two tribes of Israel. They made a pact. They were going to help each other. Each tribe was sort of given a responsibility to drive out people from one part of the promised land. And so Judah and Simeon made a pact that I'll help you drive out of your area. You help me drive them out of my area. Okay, sounds like a good plan. And but they didn't totally destroy everybody. In Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 and 2, it talks about the command they had been given to drive them all out. It says, and I'll just read these. You don't have to turn there. Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 and 2 says, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you're entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and has defeated them, you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy." You know, that's a hard teaching, right? You know, it's easy to read this as an ancient story and just blow right past that. But imagine if that was a command you had been given. Okay? Destroy them totally. Men, women, and children, right? That was the command they were given. And show them no mercy. You know, and because what was the problem? They were going to, if they didn't do that, their idols and their evil practices were going to infiltrate Israel and cause them to leave God. That was God's warning to them to do that. Well, in Judges chapter 1, starting in verse 21, we find out that they didn't do that. I'm going to read I'll jump a couple of times in this, but verse 21 says, "The Benjamites, however, failed to dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. To this day, the Jebusites live there with the Benjamites." Verse 25, "So he showed them and they put the city to the sword, but spared the man and his whole family." So here's somebody they spared. Verse 27, "But Manasseh did not drive out the people of Bethshan or Taanak or Dor or Ibleam or Megiddo and their surrounding settlements, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. When Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but they never drove them out completely. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, but the Canaanites continued to live there among them. Neither did Zebulun drive out the Canaanites living in Kitron or Nahalol, who remained among them, but they did subject them to forced labor. Nor did Asher drive out those living in Akko or Sidon or Ahlab or Akzib or Helba or Aphek or Rehob. And because of this, the people of Asher lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. Neither did the Naphtali drive out those living in Beth Shemesh or Beth Anath. But the Naphtalites too lived among the Canaanites living in the land, and those living in Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath became forced laborers for them. The Amorites confined the Danites to the hill country, not allowing them to come down to the plain. And the Amorites were determined also to hold out in Mount Heriz, Aijalon, and Shalbim. But when the power of the house of Joseph increased, they too were pressed into forced labor." So what do you see? We got a big problem, right? You've got the Israelites coming into the promised land. They've got all these idolatrous cultures within there, living in, you know, all this sin, all this, these people that were not not obedient to God, did not have any regard for God's law. So in Judges chapter 2, starting in verse 1, we have God's message back because they hadn't driven them all out. "The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I brought you out of Egypt and I led you into the land I swore to give to your forefathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now, therefore, I tell you that I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. Okay, so bad news. Chapter 3, verse 1. These are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan. He did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of the Israelites who had not had previous battle experience. So, you know, he left them there because they didn't drive them out, okay? But it also says so that they would be prepared for war, so they'd learn war. Now, you might imagine that if they had done everything God told them to, they wouldn't really have to learn war, would they? You know, God had fought their battles up to this point, right? But now they were going to have to learn war. So one of the consequences of not obeying God. So he goes on in verse 3. Here are the ones that the Lord left there. The five rulers of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, and the Havites, living in the Lebanon mountains, from Mount Baal Hermon to Lebo Hamath. They were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's commands, which he had given their forefathers through Moses. The Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. So there they go. You know, you think, okay, we can just put ourselves right up next to these ungodly people and we can stay righteous. Not true. Not true. There's got to be a separation. Now, Jesus said we need to be in the world but not of the world. Okay? But there's limits to how far into the world you can go. How much of the world can you bring into your life? You know, how much can you let come in on your television and your internet? And how much, being careful who your kids associate with and who you associate with. And, you know, there's a limit to how far you can go and stay righteous. And God had told them to completely destroy. And they didn't do it. And the result of it was that they served their gods. So, you know, we have here, you could do a whole study here of the play between free will and the sovereignty of God. Because God knew they were going to not drive them all out. He knew that they would disobey. But he still put the people there to test them. Okay, to demonstrate. But they did have a command they could have obeyed, but they didn't do it. Okay, so there was free will, but there was also, God knew in advance how this was going to turn out. So God left the nations in their midst, and then they intermarried with the nations, and then God gave them over to Aram for 8 years. Okay, Aram. Then God raised up Othniel to deliver them from Aram. You know, they get oppressed by this conqueror, and then they'd cry out to God, and God would raise up a deliverer. And this time it was Othniel. This is the same Othniel that married Caleb's daughter in Joshua. Chapter 15, verses 16 and 17. Basically, Caleb had said, I'll give my daughter in marriage to whoever conquers this particular group of people. And then Othniel did it, and he married Joshua's daughter, Caleb's daughter. And so, he comes in there, and he delivers Israel from Aram. Okay. Then we get to Judges chapter 3, and we get to Moab situation. Basically, here we have Israel conquered by Eglon, king of Moab, and they were subjected to them for 18 years, and then they cry out to God, and God raises up Ehud. There's this whole sordid story. Ehud sneaks into, basically comes to the king Eglon. And he has a secret message for him. He tells everybody to leave the room. Ehud goes up and stabs him with a knife and escapes through the balcony. Okay, so he kills the king and then Israel is able to be free from them. And they had 80 years of peace. So 80 years of peace. That's pretty good. Okay. So, and he doesn't tell us a whole lot about those 80 years of peace, but somewhere in there were some good times, followed by some sin, and then that ended the peace, right? So then we have Israel subject to the Canaanites, to Jabin, for 20 years. Okay, this is in Judges 4. And here we have Deborah and Barak. So God tells Deborah, he's going to deliver them from Canaan. And so she contacts Barak and says, you need to go out there and do this because God has said he's going to be with you and we're going to overcome. And Barak says, well, I'll only go if you go with me. Okay, so Deborah says, okay, but God will give the deliverance by a woman instead of by you. So sure enough, you know, this whole thing goes down. The Israelite army under Barak is, you know, and God's talking to Deborah. Deborah's giving the direction to Barak. Barak's going out there doing it. They're conquering and setting their people free. And then the leader of Barak's army, Sisera, is fleeing. And he tries to hide in this woman's tent, Jael's tent. And he goes to sleep. She comes up to him with a tent stake, drives it through his head. And so their military leader is dead, and then they've been conquered. So again, you know, and there we have the conquest given at the hand of a woman. So then we have the famous song from Deborah. This big celebration where she's basically rejoicing that God has delivered Israel. And she, you know, there's a famous verse in here that I want to talk about just for a minute. You've heard sermons preached on this one too. It says, when the princes of Israel take the lead, when the people willingly offer themselves, praise the Lord. And there's a lot of different ways that's been translated. It's a little kind of a difficult translation. But the point that's been made from that is, you know, when you've got a king and or a ruler and a leader, and then the people do what he says, then it's great. But that's not what the point of the book is. It's exactly the opposite of that, actually. Look at a few translations there. Praise ye the Lord for the avenging of Israel when the people willingly offered themselves. Right? This didn't happen because some ruler told them what to do. This happened because people willingly offered themselves. That's what was being celebrated here. Was the whole scheme of the judges was sort of illustrated right here, where the people voluntarily did the right thing. And how beautiful a thing that was. That's what the verse is about. And, you know, the K&D commentary on the next slide, Sherry, talks about this translation. It says, the meaning is, for the fact that the strong in Israel put forth strength to prove oneself willing. Here, to go into battle of their own free will without any outward and authoritative command. You know, that's basically what was happening here. They did it without somebody in authority making them do it. And so the attack was directed by God, speaking through Deborah, fought by those who were willing, and that's kind of the era of the judges. That was when it was going well. Okay, they sinned again. We're in chapter 6. They were oppressed by the Midianites, and God raises up Gideon. So Gideon's. You know, the angel comes to Gideon to set them free. And Gideon is threshing wheat in a wine press, okay, which is really a pretty pitiful sight. And most of us have never threshed wheat, never, you know, seen a wine press. But basically, what they're doing, they're threshing wheat. You know, you're throwing it up in the air. The wind is carrying off the lightweight stuff, and the good stuff falls back down. Okay, that's threshing wheat. Well, he's in a wine press. There's no wind. You know, wine press is an enclosed area. And so he's like futilely trying to thresh wheat inside this wine press to hide from the Midianites, because they were coming through. They were destroying their food, destroying their crops. They were, you know, basically impoverishing them. And so he's down there doing this. And then Gideon calls and says, mighty warrior, you know, go and set the people free, and God will be with you. Go and Gideon's like, who am I? You know, why? I don't know what. You know, I'm the least in my father's clan. You know, and so basically he says, go in the strength you have. Gideon offers him an offering, and it's consumed by fire. He says, okay, so I guess that message was from God. But then he says, I got to test God again. But first, God tests Gideon. Gideon, he has him go tear down his father's altar to Baal. And he cuts down the Asherah pole, builds a proper altar. He burns the Asherah pole, sacrifices a bull on it. But he does all this at night because he's afraid of the people. Okay, the people, he's afraid he's going to get in big trouble for it, and he could have. But he did it. He obeyed, and God took that obedience. Then he goes out to prepare for battle, and before he calls the people together, and before he starts to go out to battle, he says, okay, one more time, I got to see, is this really from God? Are you really with me? So he does this thing with fleece. Puts fleece out in the evening, and in the morning, he says, God, if this is really from you, when I wake up, let there be dew on the fleece, but not on the ground. So he wakes up the next morning, he checks it, and there's dew, you know, he just wrings a bunch of water out of the fleece, but the ground around it is dry. And then he thinks, you know, come to think about it, I'm not so sure, maybe that's what would have happened anyway. So he says, let me put some fleece out again. This time, if it's really you, God, let the fleece be dry, but the ground around it be wet. And so the next morning he gets up, and that's the way it is. So he says, okay, I get it. I think I get it finally. I'm going to do what you said. And so he starts to lead the people out, and God says, okay, but you got too many warriors with you. You got too many. If you conquer with that group, you're going to think you did it with your own strength. So he says, tell everybody who's afraid to go home. And a whole bunch of people go home. But not everybody. So he's still got too many. So he says, okay, now we're going to take them over here to this river and get a drink of water. The ones who lap the water like a dog, you're going to keep. And the ones who bend over and scoop it in their hands, you're going to let them go home. And so then finally he ends up with 300 people. He says, okay, those are the people you're going to take, and you're going to go conquer Midian. And so basically, Gideon now is like, he's still kind of nervous, kind of scared. He's seen some pretty amazing things. But now he's got 300 people to go after this huge army. And he says, okay, God says, let me encourage you. You know, this tells you a little bit about God. He's not just going to send them out there terrified. So let me encourage you. Go over there and listen to what they're saying in the camp. Now here's this person inside the enemy camp recounting a dream he had, okay, where he dreamed, and this other person interpreting the dream. The person who interprets the dream says, this can be nothing but Gideon of the Israelites coming and destroying us all. You know, I mean, where did that come from? Well, so Gideon says, okay, yeah, I can't, that sounds encouraging. So then he goes out there and they have this great victory. They have this amazing battle plan. And their amazing battle plan is that they get these trumpets and these jars and these torches. And they come into the area and they blow their trumpet, they break their jars, and they hold up the torches and they yell. You know, I don't think that's how our typical armies fight their wars, right? Yeah. You know, but these 300 people making a bunch of noise and holding up these torches, what happened was God confused the army. They started attacking each other. The Midian army started attacking each other, and they destroyed each other. And so, God fought for them again. And then they pursued them, and they captured the leaders. And so they were set free. So then at the end of that, the Israelites came to Gideon and said, be our king. You set us free. Be our king and rule over us. Judges 8, verse 22, the Israelites said to Gideon, rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson, because you have saved us out of the hand of Midian. And he says, I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. Okay? And so, again, that's the way that God would have it. And that was his plan for ruling Israel. But on the other hand, he did say, but you can give me some of the gold that you got when we conquered, and I'll make it into this ephod. Okay, ephod. I'm not really exactly sure. Ephod was supposedly like a garment worn by a religious person, a priest or something. I'm not sure what this gold ephod made with was, but they turned it into an idol. So that became a snare to the people, that ephod that he made with that gold. So there was some good and some bad at the end of Gideon. But God used Gideon. Okay. He's one of the people named in Hebrews 11 as one of the heroes of the faith. So after Gideon, his son Abimelech became king by force. So there actually was a period about 3 years where there was a king in Judges, but it was not one that was ordained by God. He killed his brothers. He made himself ruler, and then God took him down by the Shechemites. So that was the next generation. And then there was another time where Israel did evil, and with the Baals, worshiping Baals, God punished them by the Philistines for 18 years. But then they got rid of their foreign gods, and God could bear their misery no more. And he sent Jephthah. Jephthah, I'm moving really fast now, but this is really, this is important stuff, but I'm going to have to move quick. So Jephthah basically said, he said, he made a vow to God before he went to set them free. He says, God, if you give me victory here, then when I return home from battle, the first thing that comes out of my house, I will sacrifice to you as a burnt offering. Okay? So he made this vow to God. Okay? Goes off, God gives him the victory. He comes back, first thing that comes out of his house was his daughter, his only child. Okay? So now, what's he going to do? He's made a vow. And actually, what he does, he said, Judges 11, verse 34, when Jephthah returned home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter dancing to the sound of tambourines? She was an only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh, my daughter, you have made me miserable and wretched, because I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." "My father," she replied, "you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites." Okay. And that's what happened. Yeah, she asked for a couple of months to go off and mourn with her friends, and then she came back, and she was sacrificed as a burnt offering. It's a scary, you think about, what do I do with that? I think the one very clear lesson of that is don't make those kinds of vows. Don't make those kinds of vows. And we could look in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 4 through 6, talking about making vows. It basically says, God takes no pleasure in fools. Don't make a vow and then not keep it. Okay. So, my take on it is that he had to keep the vow. Some people think, no, that was an evil thing he did when he kept the vow. I think he had to keep the vow. But I think, the other lesson of this thing is the incredible faith of his daughter. Can you imagine saying, okay, sacrifice me as a burnt offering? That was a pretty amazing thing. But yet Jephthah, and despite all of that, Jephthah was one of the heroes of the faith. In Hebrews 11, again, he's named as one of the ones who was considered a hero of the faith. So then we go on, we talk about Samson. Samson was a really enigmatic, a really puzzling character. He did some pretty bad things, and yet he also is one of the heroes of the faith. He was set apart from birth as a Nazarite. An angel announced it before he was born, came to his mother and announced that he was coming. Kind of like the angel came to Mary about Jesus, right? There's some parallels between Samson and Jesus, but there's some very big differences too. Samson kills a lion. He has this riddle that he gives to people. He says, "I'll give you 30 sets of clothes if you can solve the riddle, and you'll give me 30 sets of clothes if you can't." And then his wife-to-be, rats out on him and tells the story, and tells the riddle, and so he ends up killing a bunch of people and getting their clothes and giving them to satisfy the bet. He gets in with a prostitute at one point, his wife gets given to somebody else, and he gets mad and he, sets fire to a bunch of fields, and the people are out to kill him, and finally they arrest him. And at the end of the story, he's sitting there with his eyes gouged out, a prisoner of the Philistines, and he says, "Okay, God, one more time. Let me have my strength and let me take down the Philistines." And so he asked them to put him between these two pillars. He puts his hands against them and pushes out, and the whole temple collapses, and 3,000 Philistines are killed in that one time. So, and that was Samson. I don't know what to do with that. Okay? He believed in God. God used him to begin the delivery from the Philistines. So, I think if nothing else, it gives us hope that God can use, if God can use somebody like Samson, maybe he can use me, because Samson, he had faith, You know, he certainly had faith, but he also was rather disobedient. So anyway, the parallels with Christ. He was denounced by an angel. He was betrayed for silver. Okay, and he delivered Israel through his death. Okay, so you know, there's other things that you could point out. So anyway, but he was one of the in Hebrews 11, one of the heroes of the faith. The last five chapters of Judges, we have the events that probably actually chronologically happened earlier. We have a guy named Micah, not the Micah who wrote the Minor Prophet. This was a lot of years, hundreds of years earlier. But we have Micah, who introduced some idolatry into Israel. We have vengeance on the Benjamites. The Benjamites did some pretty sordid things, and then the other 11 tribes decided they were going to have to wipe them out, and they almost did, and then they regretted it. We know they didn't totally wipe out the Benjamites, the whole tribe of Benjamin, because who do we know of who was descended from Benjamin? Apostle Paul, right? Apostle Paul was descended from Benjamin. So they didn't completely wipe them out, but it was like they were mourning. It's almost like no one of the tribes is missing in Israel. But so you have this all these sordid things, you know, at the end. But so the period of Judges, we have recorded some bad stuff. We have recorded some good stuff. So there was good and bad that happened in under the reign of the judges, or the rule of the judges. And so next week, Gary will pick up with Samuel, the end of the judges, the beginning of the kings, and we'll continue on. So thank you, and go get your kids.